Under President Clinton, professor at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book, Saving Capitalism, For the Many, Not the Few. He's also chair of Common Cause. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Malkoff, Ravi Karan, Steve Martinez, Hani Masood, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Laguerre, engineer. Special thanks to Becky Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Coming up, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with host Paul Roland.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of Religion for Life, and this week is the third of my three-part series on clergy who have left the ministry, and in some cases, left God. My guest this week is former Seventh-day Adventist minister Ryan Bell, who took a year off from God and then blogged about it, A Year Without God. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
He was born a pauper to a pawn on a Christmas day when the New York Times said God is dead.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next three-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We've been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planRFP2015.
What are you doing this Thursday at 11 a.m.? Hopefully you're listening to Between the Covers, where I talk with living legend, author of over 60 books, Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin says, you can't change society without changing the English language. Thus, her new book for writers, Steering the Craft, inevitably engages class, gender, capitalism, politics, and morality, which for her is not separate from grammar and punctuation. Again, it's
Ursula K. Le Guin.
This Thursday at 11 on
KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, 90.7 FM in Portland.
For the lies that were spoken, for the blood that we have spilled, for the treaties that were broken, for the leaders you have stilled. 'Cause to die for your sins, 'cause to die for your sins. Now a new day must begin, 'cause to die for your sins. Tribes you terminated, for the myths you keep alive, for the land you confiscated, for freedom you deprive. 'Cause to die died for your sins.
But pretty soon,
for the truth that you pollute, for the life.
And good morning. You are, of course, listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name's Paul. Paul Roland is my last name also. And I'll be with you here with you until 9 o'clock. And that was the late, great Floyd Westerman with the anger and the optimism of the 1960s, or maybe early 70s. I can't remember exactly when that came out. But I was in the full flush of the American Indian movement and all the other movements, anti-colonization movements, civil rights movements, anti-imperialist movements that were alive at that time. And of course, we're pretty well defeated, and we're still living with that defeat, if you were. But of course, he was speaking of a much older process of the colonization of the United States. And that was addressed to us Euro-American people. And of course, it's a complex tapestry, this American culture. It's not just Euro-Americans and Africans and Native Americans, and not just Euro-Americans, Native Americans, and African-Americans. There's people from all over the world, and it's a very complex cultural framework, tapestry, as I said, that we have to deal with. But what I would like to talk about, and this is something I wanted to play on my last week's show when we were talking about the initiative against Nestle, Citizens Initiative that was filed to ban all commercial water bottling, which came upon the heels of a very powerful Native-led event in Salem. And I taped some of that. And I wanted to have a discussion on the first peoples of this land. You know, it's like there's all this discussion now of, you know, all these people are moving to Portland. I myself was one of them originally in 1985. Then I left for a long time, and I kind of came back in the midst of this tidal wave of people moving here for many different reasons. Some of them climate refugees, some of them economic refugees, perhaps some of them political refugees, some of them rank opportunists, some of them speculators. Some of them people just maybe saw Portlandia, kind of stereotype that, I guess. Lots of different reasons. People just looking for some quality of life that they weren't finding wherever else they were. And, you know, we're a mobile society. You can move around. I've certainly done it. Anyway, you know, you start to think, well, there are all these layers, you know, started out, you know, whenever it started out, depending on, you know, one's viewpoint of the original settlement by Homo sapiens of this land. A lot of the indigenous people say they've been here since time immemorial. And of course, the date keeps getting pushed back by scientists. So it's really hard to say exactly. But, you know, somewhere between, according to the Western scientific model, which I'll just put right up front, I, you know, by and large adhere to. And I know it's not everybody does. But 15,000 to 30,000, maybe 40,000 years ago, it's hard to say. Anyway, and then there's been successive waves of people. And then, of course, you know, coming after the Columbus voyages and the, of course, the Spanish came here initially among Europeans and established missions up and down the coast. I'm not sure to what extent they were present in Oregon. And then there was, of course, French trappers and traders. The first English voyages, I believe, at the end of the 18th century. Then, of course, Lewis and Clark supposedly blazed the trail for subsequent expeditions. And, of course, the Oregon Trail opened up in the 1840s. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. Anyway, Portland has been a city for, I'm not sure how long. First, Oregon City was actually the first established. It was the terminus of the Oregon Trail, a large settlement there set up. And of course, what we don't remember is that those Willamette Falls, which were so covered up by industry, paper mills, there is a thriving Native culture there at Oregon City. In fact, I actually know some people who are descendants of the people who fished there at what we now call Willamette Falls. And there's a museum out there in Oregon City, really interesting. And there's some astounding collection of artifacts. It was apparently, you know, almost next to Celilo Falls, which got flooded in the 1950s by the Dalles Dam, which was the major Native trading center for all of the Pacific Northwest. Apparently, there's trade goods found from Mexico, from the plains, from far up north. But a similar thing was there at Willamette Falls. That was a kind of a secondary trading center, but it was a major nexus, a thoroughfare for tribes coming from, you know, up north, down the Willamette River, from crossing the Columbia, from south, from the Great Basin. So, rich history. And of course, like I was starting to say, all the people, including myself when I first came here, you know, the people are moving here. You know, there's this, I saw, I think it was Willamette Week, did like an orientation guide for moving to Portland. But nobody knows anything. Very few people know much about the original history here. Does that matter? I don't know. What do you all think? I was hoping to talk about that because that the rally that happened in Salem two or three weeks ago, there's really powerful talks about the real history of the people who lived and continue to live along the Columbia River, the Wanapum people, the river people. And I was very privileged and fortunate in my first go-round in Portland in the mid-80s to mid-90s to get to know some of the people on the river and really appreciate their spirit, their culture, their tenacity, and everything they've been through, and the fact that they're so invisible. In fact, there was a major fishing rights struggle going on at that time in the early mid 1980s. And the, you know, progressive community in Portland, by and large, ignored it. And this is, you know, this is not necessarily to single them out, to criticize them in particular, because it's a cultural blind spot. It's really deep, you know. It's like it brings up real difficult issues, you know, if we think that, you know, we're sort of illegitimately here from the very beginning, which is true, because there's really no basis in international law for the establishment of the United States of America. So yeah, it brings up a lot of deep issues, really, at this psychic level that we're not even really maybe aware exists. And I think that's where we need to devote some attention. So that's what I would like to talk about this morning. But if my engineer and news and public affairs director, Kathleen Stevenson, at the board, could start out by playing this talk, as I said, at the Nchiwana Fishing People Against Nestle rally that took place a couple weeks ago in Salem. And this is a traditional Klickitat chief, Johnny Jackson. So good to see him out there, and also the other Klickitat chief, Wilbur Slokish, and other people from the river community, people from Warm Springs. It was a great experience. And so let's play that, and then we can talk about it afterwards.
Water is a source of life for all people, all beings, and all life, the animals, the fish, and the plants, the timber, and whatever grows around it. And those springs that we're going to be talking about today is where my people lived in village and homes along that river. And in that area, way before the white man came down that river. And those springs were the source of, that they used the water for their everyday life. And they respected it. It's a part of the way we look at our religion and the way we use our religion. In any important ceremony that we have, water is there for the beginning of the meals to the end. And those springs there are very sacred. There were many springs as that one is there. And our village, the villages that were there, and the people that were there, protected and used that water until the white man came and moved them out of there, moved them up to Warm Springs and some over toward Yakima. There's a very great misunderstanding by the people when they come to this part of the country and look at us people of the river. We are river people. I'm a river person, and my grandfather and the grandfathers before him, my people have had great respect, and we still have great respect for the Columbia River because it is part of our life. Today, that water is like sick from the dams. The fish is suffering in it. The only good water that we have are from them springs and from them tributaries that go into that Columbia. They are still clean yet. For how long, we don't know. Till somebody else like Nestle wants to come in and make a profit off of it. We use that water from the beginning of our lifetime to the end of our lifetime. That's how important water is to us. That's how important them springs are to us. Nobody made them springs. The Creator put that in so that we could have that water, clean water. Seemed like the new people have destroyed everything or polluted everything or done wrong to everything else around this Columbia River. Now they're starting on our precious springs. This is our way of life. And I'll never consent or give up a way to let that spring be used for anything else, but accept the way it always has been. There's been not enough damage done to the Columbia River and all our fishing areas. Let's not destroy what we have left. It's hard to make people understand our way of life and the way we look at this earth that we are a part of. We are a part of that earth, that land where those springs come out from. When we go back, we go back to the earth as part of that. You look at what's happening to your fish nowadays, that's because it's what's been done to the Columbia River. The only place that the fish can find a best place to survive and replenish is by the water coming from them springs, like that area there. All them tributaries in that area was a village site of my people on both sides of the river, and they were removed. We never depended on the mighty dollar or anything. We always had food. Our food was in the mountains. Our food is around that area where those springs are. Our medicine was right there. We didn't have to go to no clinic or doctor to get our medicine. It was there, provided for us. That's how important that spring is to us. And any other spring along there, where I live, over in Underwood, there used to be a spring up on that hillside. It's no more because people developed above it and drained it out. There has to be an understanding between your people and my people to know what is important in life. for each other. You people depend on clean water. We've always had clean water. But if you allow somebody to come in and destroy it and use it for something else, then we lose it. And what good is it going to do? It's only going to make him a prophet. He doesn't care whether you survive from it or anybody else. And it's not his to take. Sometimes, in our way, water is a medicine. You can't live without it. Even your people can't live without it. And our springs and our water is not for sale. It's not to give to anybody.
And again, that was Chief Johnny Jackson of the Klickitat, the river people, speaking at a rally, Inchiwana Fishing People Against Nestle rally, on the steps of the Capitol in Salem. And so, yeah, I want to talk about that hidden history. And of course, there's many hidden histories or many uncomfortable histories, many uncomfortable conversations to have. This is one of them. Obviously, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of indentured servitude, the legacy of originally, you know, Europeans, Irish people, other people, and virtual slavery of Chinese workers on the railroads. All these things, which it's sort of so easy just to say, but to actually grapple with them and to reckon with them. And, you know, there's been these truth and reconciliation commissions, you know, in South Africa, in Guatemala. I don't know how many people know, but there was one in the state of Maine in the last couple of years that apparently I went to a conference where there's a number of people who were participating in it in D.C. this summer. And by their accounts, it was the most in-depth, most comprehensive such process in the history, in world history, that it really, they really got deep into it. It had to do with boarding schools, had to do with foster homes, had to do with really deep issues of the state messing with the lives and culture of Native people. And as I said, you know, we've never really, you know, there's claims for requests for reparations for slavery. There's all these deep historical wrongs that that linger and that are present, and it's so readily present. If you go out to the river and look at those communities, go out to the reservations. And anyway, I don't want to talk much further at this point. I wanted to stimulate some conversation, and the phone number here is 503-231-8187 if you would like to pursue this particular conversation. And we do have a caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I was just talking about this the other day, how if you bring up, you know, everybody wants to talk about how they want to restore America's honor and, you know, they want to bring dignity or whatever back to our country, but it's, you know, but it's like when you start talking about, well, you know, the Native Americans, this is their land first. A lot of people get, you know, because you don't really have an answer for it, because our economy has been based so much on greed and taking that the idea that this land doesn't really belong to any of us really starts striking a chord with people who think they can just come out here and develop and just take what they want. And in reality, this is nobody's to take. And I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people don't have this conversation, but I think that's it. You know, it's built on this sort of like willful ignorance or plausible deniability.
Well, might makes right, as we know.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I you know, people, they just, you know, you just, I can't, you know, I don't know. It's like people just get so defensive about it. It's like when you realize how much land was taken and how much, and how the cultures of Native, not only North Americans, but also Central and South Americans, how they've been decimated almost to extinction, kept alive only through what elders were able to escape or through diasporic beliefs. I mean, it's really shocking, and the fact that so much of it is glazed over. I mean, that's why I have such a huge problem with Thanksgiving. You know, I don't like celebrating Thanksgiving for that reason, because it's like saying, well, European colonists and the natives, they made nice for a meal, but really they saw them as a bunch of devil worshippers and wanted their land because they, you know, manifest destiny, white man's burden, whatever you want to call it. That's what took hold.
Yeah. So, how do we make these, effective in, because I think it's important, obviously, to continue, to what extent we're able to actually slow down or stop this massive machine that seems to be inexorably grinding up our precious planet and our daily lives and everything else along with it. We seem to, find it hard. You know, there's been waves of resistance. There's been various theoretical approaches. I guess what I'm getting at is just a simple honesty, like us facing ourselves. I don't want to take steam away from like activist efforts to deal with at whatever level, bureaucratic, state, regulatory, whatever. I guess what I'm saying is there's a deeper level here that we need to come to terms with. It's not, I guess one thought I had early this morning when I woke up and was thinking about this, it's not class, it's culture.
Yes.
There's this deep cultural, it's like it's almost like in focusing on like internal relationships in our society, we can sort of avoid this fact that there was this original clash, fundamental clash of cultures that happened and still is here, regardless of how overlaid it's been.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a, and it's really present when you look at the people who like you were playing Johnny Jackson representing the Klickitat, but it's like you see a lot of representatives of Native American culture, and they're not people all the time who are actually, we have a lot of imposters out here. And a lot of the imposters are the ones who get a lot of the airtime for being able to represent folks who are from, at least on syndicated radio, folks who are they push themselves off as representatives of the Native American community. And it's almost and it's like anything else, trying to put a white face on a brown culture, so it seems almost accessible, I guess. But I think the deeper answer for trying to restore certain things is we need to get back to a spirituality, because even the Native Americans are deeply spiritual people, but their belief in how everything is connected is important, because the culture of the Europeans is to say, well, it's our way or the highway, and we were created to dominate.
Yeah, you're speaking to some extent in generalities. I appreciate the overall tenor of what you're saying, but I think we need to get even more into the specific nitty gritty of this stuff. But we have a couple other callers. You want to kind of wrap up your point there?
Well, that's really, I mean, I know that I'm speaking in generalities, but I mean, just getting to a spirituality that doesn't cause us to think we're above, but to realize that we're all connected, because we've tried living above the land and dominating the land, and it's done nothing except cause ruin. So we need to lose our superficial sense of being above it all. And being, and realize that we need to be more apart in what we can do to, even if we're going to continue to grow, that we grow in a way that's sensible and reflects being a part of the ecosystem, not above it.
Right on. I can't disagree with that. And I guess what I'm getting at, and thank you for calling, James. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
All right. And I guess what I'm getting at is I agree with what he's saying, but I think we need specific modalities and processes for getting there. I mean, it's all great to talk about it, but how do we actually, you know, that's why, you know, this, the idea of a truth and reconciliation process is really interesting to me. It would be a major thing, and we certainly have a lot to deal with here in Oregon, being the state that was most heavily impacted by the termination process, where the government, federal government, unilaterally terminated the existence, if you can imagine such a thing, of, I'm not sure it was 12 or 14 or 16 different tribal entities in the 1950s, and just sent them reeling into a terrible cultural spiral of really disintegration, just massive social cultural impacts to the Klamath, the Coos, the Grand Ronde, the Salettes, and a number of others. And that's a legacy that we have to deal with here. And I'm just sort of putting it out there because, you know, obviously these major, major things are looming upon us. Climate change, ecological breakdown, economic crisis. But the root of it, at least here in America, the root of it, you know, the deeper root of it is another subject, but the root of it here was, you know, the process of colonization. And that's something we really have to come to terms with as we're, you know, fighting these individual battles. So some sort of a process I'm sort of putting out there. And on an individual psychic level, it's really difficult because we need support. And sometimes we can feel very isolated in having these thoughts and insights if other people around us do not share them. So that's why I think it's important to talk about them. But we got other callers. Derek, you're on the air.
Hi there. This has been a fascinating discussion. And I agree that the spirituality and the reconciliation of the recent crimes, you know, even in our own lifetimes, in some cases, like this, this abolishment of the tribes that you just mentioned is, you know, horrific. But I've just been coming to the realization through various sources in the last few years about what incredible depth and size of the societies were that were in the Americas before Columbus and friends arrived with influenza and smallpox and absolutely committed an accidental genocide before the intentional genocide. I believe the figure on Vancouver Island, just on Vancouver Island in BC, was like several million people living on Vancouver Island 1,000 years ago, you know, on the salmon and their agriculture and so on. And I just saw something about an entire society covering a vast area of South America, which is currently just like a marsh that nobody lives in, that was formerly, you know, an agricultural tilled area with people building mounds and villages and canals and just this extraordinary landscape that we don't know anything about. And the people who were here were just absolutely devastated by disease brought by Europeans and then further devastated because their numbers were reduced by the disease. And that is just an amazing piece of information that's honestly, I think, relatively new to the general understanding in just the last couple of decades. I just had to throw that in there.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, you know, it's so easy to think of Native Americans as like a small, fragmentary group or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, I see where you're going. No, I mean, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, is really breathtaking in the way it lays that out. I was blown away. I thought I had read a lot of stuff and knew, but the intricacy and the extent of the trade net of the trade. What's that?
Yeah, I should read that book. Apparently.
Oh, it's really it's an excellent book. It's an excellent book. I understand there's some reading groups around town that have been going on, the trading networks, the complexity of the interrelationships. You know, that we just that we're just so, yeah. I mean, and what you're saying, the disease, yes, but the really horrible thing, you know, is that people, basically Europeans, took advantage of that. And then,
right.
You know, basically, you know, people who were already weakened, in a weakened state, they waged genocidal warfare on a weakened, you know, not always, but generally they were relatively weak compared to what they had been, you know, just 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 years before. And, you know, and saw, and actually there's a lot of references to people actually writing in their journals and stuff that they saw that as a sign from God, that they were the favored people, that, you know, that they were already, that they were weakened. And, you know, that's that ideology that James was talking about, the superior cultural superiority complex.
Yep.
Well, anyway, thank you for calling.
Absolutely.
And anybody else who has a call, 503-231-8187. And again, we're talking about, you know, the legacy that we're dealing with of colonization. I kind of started out, framed it in the idea, you know, people are talking about all these new people moving to Portland, and the, you know, it's a real issue. You know, all these things are real issue. It's like these layers and layers, you know, it's almost like a social archaeology, living social archaeology. But, you know, there, all these levels are relevant, and you can't deny that, you know, the issues of, you know, clearly for people, the issues of the rents going up, the having a hard time finding housing, houselessness, all the social issues, which have basically been compound. It's almost like compound interest or something. It's kind of, to use a horrible sort of financial metaphor there. But, you know, it really, all these problems compound, but based upon, you know, as Floyd Westerman sung at the beginning, Custer died for your sins. You're referring obviously to Euro-Americans, that, you know, there was an original colonization, and that's what set in motion all of this. And I am saying that we are living with the consequences of that, just as we're living with the consequences of bringing millions and millions of people on slave ships in chains, and working many of them to death and treating them abysmally. And then all the, you know, way to the present that continues with the social and psychic and cultural problems facing African Americans, and, you know, every other group. You know, my own people were German and Danish. The Germans were fleeing warfare in southern Germany in the early to mid 18th century. And of course, then they came here, and my ancestor fought in the Virginia militia against the Native Americans in the pre-Revolutionary War era, the so-called French and Indian Wars. And it's so complex. And I think, you know, the Sweetwater Nanauk's workshop this past weekend was really powerful, really well attended, you know, and talking about really the need, you know, it's really helpful for each of us as part of our work, whatever we're doing, is to really, you know, try to understand where we came from. Because this process of being able to continually move and move and move across the frontier, the new frontier, et cetera, the mobility culture, I mean, that's maybe coming to an end. Maybe we can't continue to, you know, as part of using fossil fuels, flying and taking these private internal combustion automobiles everywhere, this freedom that we supposedly have, it has its underside. It's terrible, terrible underside. It's always at a cost, both at a cost of what you leave behind and a cost to the materials that you're using up in the process, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we're trying to address here in this radio show. It looks like we got some callers. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi,
yeah.
Franny,
hi. Sorry, didn't catch your name.
Oh, no problem. A couple of things I wanted to say. One, in your long list of oppressed peoples, you left out women. And I just want to say that all throughout the world, the most oppressed group is women. So, meaning we're the most oppressed. So Just a point there I wanted to make on that. And then also I think, you know, it's interesting because you say, well, what are the solutions? I think, you know, the world is plentiful. The only thing that's not plentiful is money, and money is a cultural construct. So, you know, getting back to sort of the Native American way of thinking of the sort of plentifulness, if that's a word, of the world, and talking about these things openly, as you're doing on the show, I think that's really the only way we're going to get away from the paradigm of, you know, the all importance of money.
Well,
move into the next phase of humanity.
And yeah, no, I, you know, it almost seems like, I don't know, just sort of silly to some people, you know, to say you have a problem with money. Like so many of these things, you know, when you question these sort of fundamental building blocks of this culture, it seems kind of odd or you know, weird or
awkward.
Whatever, awkward, you know. But yeah, I mean, I sometimes just have this sort of, I don't like holding the stuff sometimes. Sometimes it's just normal, you know, but sometimes it just seems so weird. But those moments, those fleeting moments of feeling that, we need to build upon those moments, I think.
Exactly.
But anyway, getting back to your point about women, that's quite rightly taken. And, but I get, the way I would say it, but I would say that it's part of the cultural problem. So I guess the way I want to frame it is that, you know, not to say that, you know, there was no gender, you know, relation, sex relation issues in, you know, the peoples lived here. I don't know. I was never a part of those cultures. I think certainly the problems are much greater now that we've brought this other cultural, you know, system. So I think that's, you know, I do, from what I've read, apparently the differences between genders, the sexual differences were very different and less pronounced, from what I understand, in most indigenous cultures. That's a gross generalization. So again, it's part of this, again, we're dealing with this cultural problem of this, whatever this kind of culture that was brought here, which is the main problem. I guess that's my point.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying that when I'm saying that, I'm saying, you left that out of your list. You left women out of the list. Not that, you know, I'm not calling out Native Americans in particular for treatment of women. In fact, I agree with you from everything I've heard. I think there was more equality between the sexes in the Native American cultures than in other cultures. And again, that comes down to not having this cultural construct of money, right? Because money is going to oppress every group that can be oppressed around the world. But money is not going to be the sort of the greed, the desire for money. And greed is a whole other topic. I mean, I think it's a social disease and should be seen as such.
Yeah, there's a discussion on Stephanie Potter's show about psychopaths, which I thought was really interesting.
That is interesting stuff, and that keeps coming up too in other places. And I think that's also something to look at as we reframe the conversation, which is what we're all doing, right? So anyway, well, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's always great to have new voices and old voices and people exchanging ideas in this fleeting hour-long talk show format that we have. So let's go to another caller. David, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here. Hey, I just wanted to put in a plug, you know, with all this talk about how it's been so difficult for the Native people here on Turtle Island. I read a book that really brought it a lot closer to home. It's called The Indians of the Pacific Northwest, From the Coming of the White Man to Present Day. It's a Vine Deloria Jr. book, which, you know, he also wrote, for those of you who don't know, Custer Died for Your Sins.
I thought I had a copy that I was going to read some after playing that song I played the Floyd Westerman song, Custer Died for Your Sins, at the beginning of the show. But anyway, continue, please.
Yeah. It's called Indians of the Pacific Northwest by Vine DeLauria Jr. And it's a small book. It's a small paperback. It's so informative. And after I read that book, when I go driving up the Columbia, or especially when I drive up to Seattle, and I get into, like, to the Delta there, right at the bottom of Puget Sound, Thurston County, before you get to Olympia, and all that lush land, and I just think about everything differently, about what it must have been like. And it's a typical story. There's a lot of talk about a lot of different nations that were around here, and they even had great trading partnerships with the French and the English. And then when the U.S. established a territory, the governor started making promises and breaking them, and so on and so forth. Same story. But I just wanted to give a plug for that book, because it really does help a person like me, or and maybe many of the listeners who've lived here a long time or most of our lives. It kind of helps to bring it home, like right here to our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I have to say.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that.
You bet.
We've mentioned two books. We've mentioned Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, which we've had her on, KBOO, a couple times, Indigenous People's History of the United States, and The Indians of the Pacific Northwest by Vine DeLauria. And of course, it's true. He wrote Custer Died for Your Sins. He wrote Red Earth, White Lies, I believe. And the names he wrote, he wrote probably 15 or 20 books. He was fundamental in the kind of resurgence of Native scholarship, or kind of the modern origins of modern Native scholarship in the 50s and 60s. Kind of led an Indian youth movement in the late 50s. And great figure. We miss him greatly. And we're talking, I wanted to frame the discussion not so much, we're talking about Native Americans, but about our culture. And this term I kind of came up with, Americaners, kind of corresponding to Afrikaners, that really resonated with me. The idea that we really, us, I mean, Euro-Americans, I certainly identify with that. On my mom's side, I go back to before the American Revolution, Western Virginia, then Kentucky, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Illinois, ended up in Kansas. And all along the way, there is displaced Native people, and they participated more or less directly or indirectly in that whole process. So getting to know that really enriched my life. It really gave me a real kind of really family's eye view. My mom actually wrote a book about our Alkire family history, and in the process just found a lot of really amazing information about daily life and the social life and U.S. history, again, from a real kind of ground's eye, family's eye view. And I would really recommend, if you have any time, to look into your family history. So Americaners, we are Americaners, those of us who are identify as European Americans, and we have the same, relationship fundamentally to the indigenous people here as the Afrikaners, the Dutch Afrikaners had, who settled in South Africa and ended up creating the apartheid system. Because we've had kind of even more of a burden, historical burden, because not only did we colonize, but we enslaved millions of Africans. So we have this dual, and actually more than dual, because of all the other relationships with ethnic groups. So I'm speaking as a European American, and I'm struggling on my own to come to terms with that history. And I think it's an important part of, grappling with this monster that we're dealing with that is destroying our very climate and our biosphere. Anyway, we've got about 10 minutes left, and we got a couple more callers. Bob, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul.
Hello.
I think what you're talking about is the empire's attack on the tribal peoples. And what don't these entities have in common? And I think what it is that the tribal peoples inherently learn how to live in a harmonious way with the planet. And the imperial mindset does not. And the interesting thing about all this is that we were all tribal once upon a time, Europeans included. You know, look back into the European paganism and its tribalism and how they were systematically destroyed by this thing.
But the question is, what is this thing and how and where did it start?
Oh, well, see, I can only give it a label of imperialism. And to me, imperialism is something that totally does not live in harmony with the universe around it. It doesn't care. It literally eats itself. It cannibalizes itself. And how did it get to this? I think there's a direct question. I think that's directly connected to what you made, a very good comment that you made earlier, considering how imperialism basically drive its subjects crazy into more like a psychopathic narcissism that's so into itself. It doesn't care about the outside environment that it needs in order to live. I mean, it's a type of insanity. And we need to address that insanity because, as you can see, as I can see, as we all can see, that disharmonious, that disharmony only breeds more insanity, and it causes us to ask these very deep fundamental questions about our war on the tribal peoples of this planet and how we need to, and look at this. I'll make this quick. There is a paradigm shift. And once upon a time, back in the 70s, people used to have ashtrays everywhere, really nice ornamental ashtrays in their houses. Why? Because it was everyone smoked, and as people became more aware of what smoking does, I don't see ashtrays in anyone's houses anymore. Now, that's a paradigm shift, and I think we're going through it right now. The only issue is that I think we are afraid of the people who have been indoctrinated by this imperialism, because we know they're going to go down kicking and screaming. We understand this, and I mean from a pacifist point of view, which is why we really watch our words. We're very tactful, and we're so tactful that many may lose the point behind what we're saying because we're afraid that the imperials, the people with the mindset who are really responsible for presently, not just in the past, but presently killing the tribal peoples who just so, and we're waking up.
You know what? You know, you're bringing together things in a way that's remarkably parallel to sort of where I was wanting to get to from the very beginning. I really appreciate that. That whole idea of being driven crazy, I think we have a hard time with that, the idea that maybe our minds are not functioning in like the most healthy or harmonious way because we've been forced to adapt to a mad system, and it's threatening. It, you know, the term cognitive dissonance, it creates a dissonance with the system itself. And we have to spend so much psychic energy I don't blame anybody. It's like you got to survive. But the problem is that adaptation, you know, Martin Luther King had that great saying about, you know, I don't want to adjust to a, you know, an insane society or whatever, you know. And but the question is, so we need to develop, again, I want to get back, we need to develop specific modalities and techniques for getting away from that madness, that insanity.
Well, that's the point I was trying to make you. make to you that technology is starting to create a feedback loop to where people are becoming more and more aware of what's going on around them, and we're changing our habits, and the revolution is starting within. It's just that these modalities aren't, in my opinion, aren't going to be very thought out. They're just going to happen.
Hmm.
People want to stop hurting themselves. And I'll get off the air and let you put your closing comments and everything else. Show, thank you very much, Paul.
All right. Thank you. That was interesting. We got any more callers? We got one more. Let's go to that, and then I'll wrap it up here. Franny, you're on the air. Maya.
Specific idea for you, and that's in order to reclaim Thanksgiving, that instead of a day of indulgence, that we make it a day of gratitude, where we go and do projects in support of life and land, and maybe it could be dovetailed with the Audubon bird count, which is done about that same time. So instead of eating the bird, we could go out and count the birds.
Well, that's one. And then, you know, I think it's good to hear that Charlie Hales apparently is going to make an announcement about changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, like they did up in Seattle. I mean, these are symbolic things, and you know, like a one day thing is a good thing, but. And I like what you're saying, and we need to take time out, and it is important to, like,
well, I think rename and reclaim Thanksgiving.
Yes,
and it could start in the Northwest, and I think the idea, if people would grab onto it and do their own things, that we could make it a day of going out onto the land, and you know, doing service and just reconnecting with what we've received, and you know, maybe Indigenous people can lead that, and there can be acknowledgement of you know, what we've received again from them. And I Thanksgiving is just so over with.
I agree, and that's so let's continue that conversation, because we are it is coming up. Both so-called Columbus Day and so-called Thanksgiving are coming up, and. That will lead me into talking about a couple things, and I appreciate your calling.
Thanks.
And thank you, and we're about out of time here. So I'm just going to wrap up. Won't be able to take any more callers. Thank everybody for calling. So as I mentioned, I heard Charlie Hales is going to make an announcement about changing Columbus Day. I think I was right about that. On October 14th, 2015, in cities and towns around the nation, people will be engaged in a national day of action to once again call attention to the urgent need for bold steps to be taken to address the global climate crisis. Initiated by the People's Climate Movement, these actions are being organized by local groups and organizations from the wide range of diverse constituent communities. This is put out by Indigenous Environmental Network. Also, some things coming up on October 2nd, just in a couple days, March on the University of Washington, Friday, October 2nd, University of Washington will be in its first week of fall term. Students and faculty will be returning, and freshmen will be starting anew. University administration would like the new academic year to kick off without a hitch, and they celebrate this homecoming with their annual Dog Days week of events. But public pressure against the Animal Lab will follow them into the new year. There's no turning back, and the second march on the University of Washington will make that abundantly clear. April 25th, the first watch on UW, 500 people took to the streets to show broad public advocacy for animals in opposition to UW and Skanska's plans. I guess that's a animal lab testing outfit. It was a watershed moment. Anyway, so hashtag March on UW, hashtag No New Animal Lab, hashtag We Will Stop This Lab. That's coming up tonight and tomorrow at Cinema 21 on Northwest 21st, Gaining Ground, Portland premiere screening, followed by a discussion with the filmmakers and people featured in the film. A new film by Kay Buzon, Barbara Bernstein, and Elaine Velasquez. From farms in Oregon's fertile Willamette Valley to the food desert in Richmond, California, Gaining Ground reveals the courage of urban and rural farmers committed to empowering their communities. Another thing, people are called upon to call Governor Kate Brown and stand up for climate action and clean energy jobs. Or will she support corporate special interests? That is on the Jordan Cove planned liquid natural gas export terminal against which a group of committed people organized a month-long hike the pipe of the proposed route for the gas pipeline. And I'm sure you can look that up. Governor Brown, stand up to the FERC on LNG, statewide something or other. That's the Facebook page, if you want to look that up. And I will try to link to that on this page for Wednesday Talk Radio and some of the books and other information. So thank you so much for listening. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Roland. Coming up, more great programming here on KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What are you doing this Thursday at 11 a.m.? Hopefully you're listening to Between the Covers, where I talk with living legend, author of over 60 books, Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin says, "You can't change society without changing the English language." Thus, her new book, For Writers, Steering the Craft, inevitably engages class, gender, capitalism, politics, and morality, which for her is not separate from grammar and punctuation. Again, it's
Ursula K. Le Guin
this Thursday at 11 on
KBOO.